Remind all participants this conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. You may begin.
Thank you, Kelly. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone on today's PEDNR call on Tuesday, the 4th of May. We have Alan Greenberg, Tatiana Kramsova, Siva Mutsami, Paul Diaz, Jeff Eckhouse, James Bladel, Michaeli Nalon, Matt Serlin, Ron Wickersham, Ted Suzuki only on Adobe Connect. From staff, we have Glenda Saint-Géry, Marika Konings, Margie Milam, and myself, Gisela Gruber-White. We have apologies from Mason Cole, Mikey O'Connor, Barry Cobb. May I please remind everyone to state their names when speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you. Over to you, Alan.
Thank you, Gisela. All right. The only item on the agenda today is to review the current draft of the what we were calling survey results. It's turned into a new poll, but based heavily on the previous one. And there is one other thing which will come up in the midst of the discussion regarding compliance, ICANN's compliance group's view of how to handle transfers during post-expiration. Paul, you've got to drop off in about 25 minutes. Are there any issues you want to highlight for us before we start the going through it point by point?
Thanks, Alan. No, at this point, why don't we just go through, because
okay.
I see there are a lot of changes, so let's let people go point by point. I think it's
probably
the best way.
All right. Everyone should have control of their own screen. We'll start off on, I don't think there's anything controversial on the first page other than the process followed. And the process followed was generally agreed to by the drafting team. I will say this: the current draft is largely mine, but based heavily on the previous one. So if you don't like it, it's my fault, not Marika's. All right. Question one: these questions have been renumbered, but they're essentially the questions in most cases from the previous survey. This is the generic one on should recovery be allowed. The first response was unanimous, and the options on this survey are essentially change policy, adopt a best practice, which doesn't address the unanimous response, and the last is status quo, do nothing. In the absence of any Paul, yes, go ahead.
Alan, just a question for the group. Did we get a formal clarification yet from ICANN Legal about the making a change to the existing consensus policy in this particular case as expired domain has been rolled into the RIA?
No.
In other words, there was kind of this confusion about do we need to change the policy? Will we need to change the RIA? Is it enough that it's freestanding?
Yeah. At the time I was working on this, and still now, we have not gotten a formal answer. So I've generally used the whatever the previous wording was, which is often change the EDDP and occasionally change the RIA. That will have to be cleaned up if and when we get some formal determination. But at this point, no, we haven't gotten an answer, and I haven't tried to craft the wording to correspond to the answer we haven't gotten. Marika?
Alan, this is Marika. I thought I did share the feedback on that particular issue with you, and if not, I'll...
Then I'll take my foot out of my mouth and let you talk.
No, maybe I thought I sent it and I didn't, because I have been talking to legal counsel about that. And I think in short, if I summarize it well, I think they said that in principle it doesn't, the working group could go either way, but maybe for clarity's sake, it might make sense to update the EDDP so that a new link can be provided through the ICANN website and language changed. But I think in principle they said that either option could be considered. But let me find the exact language and forward that to the list for everyone's review.
Okay. And if you sent it and I missed it, my apologies.
No problem.
Any other issues on point number one? Okay. Number two is an attempt to address the issue of the timing of that. For how long should the ability exist to exchange the domain name. Now, I added into the issue description what we found out during the original registrar survey that we did at the beginning of this process, and specifically the answers from the nine registrars, because we excluded, I think it was the two GoDaddy registrars because they were identical and we merged them. The answers were one for 30 days, three for 35, and four for 40. Now here, at the last drafting team meeting, we decided to try to put ranges in to identify what people wanted. And I'm wondering, however, if instead of that it would be cleaner to simply let everyone plug a number in instead of picking a particular range. How do people feel about that?
Before that, Alan, I have something to say.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, why is there an upper limit of 45 days? Because I recollect that I indicated about 90 days. And whether I say 90 days or 900 days, it is an opinion. And why do you disregard that opinion and put an upper limit of 45 days?
The reason I put it...
If there is an option beyond 45 days, when I vote for the survey, I would choose that option, which is not there now.
The reason I put a limit of 45 days is the existing EDDP requires a registrar to delete the name after 45 days. They cannot keep it on hold waiting for a recovery past 45 days. The ICANN policy forbids it. Now, if the registrar transfers it to someone else, sells it to someone else, and you come back 6 months later and say you want it and they're good enough to get it back for you, that's a private transaction, but that's nothing ICANN can legislate because ICANN has already said they cannot keep it for longer than 45 days. James?
So has it categorically said that it cannot be...
The EDDP, the expired domain deletion policy, note the word deletion, was passed in 2004 because registrars had been holding on to expired names longer than 45 days. And the consensus policy at that point from the process that generated said 45 days they must delete. They cannot hold it longer than that.
But the whole idea of this working group is to decide whether the existing policy is good or whether it requires an amendment or whether it needs to be changed. And if we are going to be constrained by the policy of 2004, what is the point of this exercise?
Well, okay, you're voicing a voice saying you'd like the option to say more than 45. Noted. Can we let James talk, please?
Hi, Alan. James here. So I think that by just letting anyone enter a segment of time freeform may not yield the most meaningful results. They could be all over the place, and then I imagine the temptation would be there to just average them together and say that's the answer. I don't know that that's the best approach. I would submit to you that the categories is probably the most meaningful approach, and the categories are somewhat defined or the boundaries established in the responses to the registrar surveys. So you could say, for example, less than 30 days, 30 to 40 days, or 40 days or more, and just leave it as those three categories. And I was going to respond to Siva, but I think I will withdraw.
Okay. And I suspect, as we're having this discussion, I'm wondering, should we, for all questions, also have a comment field? Not an not select an other, but just a comment field, which would, in this case, allow Siva to put in 100 days if he wishes, and it may be applicable in other things for people to add things. Jeff, you're first.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, that would be a good option.
Go ahead, Jeff.
thanks. So here's my question on two, because, you know, I don't, maybe this was brought up before. Now that I'm sort of thinking this out, is the minimum time frame from which it has the ability to cover the domain name registration, and I believe you sort of addressed it in the starting point, because say I'm a small registrar or whatever it is, and I decide, hey, I can't afford the float, and to, you know, since the registries, most of them are common net registrations, the registry auto-renews, so it gets debited from my account, and I might want to delete the domains after on day three because, I, you know, whatever it is, my financial reasons, I let registrants know that in advance, saying you won't have a chance, I, you know, the domains are deleted. So is the RGP included in this question, saying what is the minimum time frame? So is that, is the RGP period taken into account on this, or are you taking it into account post-expiration before?
Okay. There's two things. Number one, from my point of view, we've always had this discussion as talking about pre-delete. So the RGP is not included. However, okay. I thought when I was wording this, I had an escape clause for to cover that situation. And on looking at it now, I do not, and there should
right.
be. Yeah.
Because I would say that it would be, because I think that if you're, it's going to be a tough piece, just, you know, just about how to move this forward, I think it would be a tough piece to say we're dictating how registrars, how they have to manage their financial obligations.
Jeff, you don't have to belabor the point. When we get to a later discussion on the RGP, I mentioned the explicit case of early deletes. It was just missing here.
Oh, no problem.
It does raise the issue of no earlier delete and no RGP is problematic.
Oh, yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, yeah, it should have been there. It wasn't. Okay, any, Michele, you're on.
I'd agree with what James was saying about the kind of bans. Like, for example, you started there 20 days. Whereas I'd be happier seeing something where it's, you know, up to 30 days or less.
Yep. I'm happy with the bans James suggests, less than 30 to 39 or 30 to 40 and 41 or more, something like that.
Yeah, and also just in terms of the deletion thing, if I need to delete it, if, for example, I have a registrant who has registered a domain that may... I don't know where this potentially cause legal issues, and that the registrant has decided that it's what allows it to expire, that I'd be able to delete it.
So you want a reference to an explicit delete request?
Yes, because as the registrar, I don't want that domain on my accreditation any longer than I absolutely have to.
No problem with that. I'll try to put some wording in, and if I miss it, you'll find it again. Any other comments? Okay, we go on next to question number three, and we're now in the set of questions which talk about the period prior to expiration. So these are the ones leading up to expiration. The discussions are about notices and other things like that. The first one is the reference to the current statement about number of notices. And I've merged that in with the question of number of the absolute number that people feel are appropriate. The general response to the initial one was strong support that we need a little bit more clarity in the RAA. So, sorry, was someone trying to speak?
Andy, me whispering to IT. Sorry, Alan, I'm on the call, not on the internet.
All right. The options are revise the language, but keep it at two, revise the language and increase the number, and I put option 3, 4, 5. I think any more than that, as a minimum, would constitute ICANN formally requiring registrars to spam people, and I think that may be excessive. That doesn't stop them from doing it if they choose, however. And the last is maintain the status quo, make no change.
Put it on the rail network.
Any comments? I hope you're finding the new format is a little bit clearer and more logical as one reads through them. Michele?
Not trying to be awkward or anything, but if...
Of course you are, Michele.
Beg your pardon?
Of course you are trying to be awkward. Come on.
I'm just trying to deal with the realities I get hit with. If you want to explicitly increase the number of notifications that are sent, I wouldn't have an issue with that in principle, but I would like to see some way of capturing the idea that the registrant could opt out of that. Because the problem we've seen a lot of is where registrants decide that they don't want to renew the domain name and then are complaining to us about sending them any notifications about the domain's expiry.
So you've just said two different things, I think. One is an explicit opt-out, and presumably that would have to be worded so it could not be the registrar default. And the other one is, if explicitly canceled, reminders don't need to be sent.
Something along those lines. I mean, basically the problem is that if we, as things stand at present, if we send out notifications to people for them to renew their domain names, we actually get people complaining.
Okay, my only comment, your requests are completely logical. I'm not sure to what extent we need the fine details in this questionnaire as opposed to in the policy should we get to the point of writing it.
Fair enough. I'm just some feedback thoughts.
I'm starting to feel there should be some things that should be in footnotes, but not necessarily asked. But we don't want people saying no, don't do it because of these caveats. So I think your points are well taken. We'll try to figure out how to do it properly. Paul?
Yeah, thanks, Alan. Just to follow what Michele said, you know, we get the same sort of criticisms, and we provide our customers with the ability to opt out of all marketing messages. A footnote is a good idea here. We might want to consider any changes if the consensus agrees that there should be a change, that they be worded in such a way that these become sort of one of the requirements from ICANN, much like the who is updating your who is information.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the way that we, for those customers who say we don't want any marketing stuff, we can still send them these required notifications because it comes, you know, we couch it under the a requirement of ICANN.
Yeah, no, and if,
handle
if,
it that
if
way.
If it ends up becoming formal policy, then you have that option. I'm moderately concerned that renewal notices would be classed as marketing, and therefore wouldn't be gotten if I say I don't want marketing.
It's amazing some people just complain about anything,
even if your
name was just taken down or hijacked.
No.
And they still get mad at us.
It's James, I'm not arguing that that there shouldn't be a way to get out of them, but if I tick off the box saying no marketing, I would hope I still get renewal notices. I have ticked off the box saying no marketing on GoDaddy, and I didn't intend that to mean no renewal notices.
You'll be getting those, right?
Well, I don't let my names expire in general, so I don't know whether I will or not. That's an interesting discussion. I think we need to have that, because if things like renewal notices are classed as marketing, then we have a real problem that many people will say, I don't want any marketing. And I'm not sure that's what they meant. That's what they mean by it in general. But I'm not sure we can cover that in this discussion. Any other things on 3? Then we go on to 4. And this is details of on when the notices are sent. In the original questionnaire, we had how and when merged into the same, and we ended up answering the how in a completely different question. So I formally separated them at this point. In the last call, I tried to craft some rules about you know, how one might say it. And I think I said one message no later than 28 days and one message no later than 7 days. And I realized that that would allow a registrar to send out two notices 11 months before expiration and meet the criteria. And I don't think that was my intent. I know that wasn't my intent. So I suggested in the drafting team call two windows. And I arbitrarily came, you know, put together basically six to, you know, one window being 6 to 4 weeks and one window being a week slightly prior to expiration with enough days left so that they probably can do something even if it's a weekend. And I'm not claiming those numbers are the right ones, but they seem as good as anything I could come up with for at least this level of survey. Anyone have a problem with what we have there? And the other options, of course, are an other option, that is, if you don't like this, specify something in particular or status quo, do nothing. Okay. This is the how part.
Alan, James?
Yes. Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, real quickly, I'm wondering, I mean, I see what you're trying to do here, and I'm wondering if it wouldn't be simpler to say that, you know, essentially one message goes out when there's one calendar month remaining, you know, or 30 calendar days or whatever remaining, and one message goes out when there's 7 calendar days. And then if you allow a plus or minus of 1 day on that target, I think that that should be, you know, without creating windows with different, you know, 56 and 28 days, I think that that might be easier to understand and easier to develop a programmatic system to generate those notices. So just my thoughts.
Well, I would have no problem with that. I put in the windows because I was trying to be as flexible and say that if a registrar is already meeting the intent, but they're not sending them out at exactly those times, that they meet the new policy.
And then you would allow something like plus or minus a couple of days to account for weekends, holidays, et cetera, and then just kind of, I don't know, that's just my thought. You get
What other people see like to see something like James is mentioning, saying 1 month and 1 week, plus or minus, or keep the windows. Or we could do 1 month plus or minus a week, and 1 week plus or minus 2 days or something like that. Like rain. Any thoughts on whether windows are the kind of thing that James is talking about is preferable? As far as I see, they're roughly the same. Michele?
I like what James is saying. I mean, windows work for me.
Windows saying a specific time plus or minus, as opposed to the type of window that I mentioned. I mean, I essentially said 6 weeks plus or minus 2 weeks and 7 days plus or minus 4 days. You know, in one week plus or minus 4 days, it would phrasing it differently.
Real quickly, Alan, I think that something like that would be much simpler for compliance to test and enforce if a registrar is not doing it. I think it would be somewhat more obvious. So that's the only reason I'm holding it out there.
Okay, Cheryl?
Thanks, Alan. I like the idea of the plus or minus a couple of days, and certainly from my own experiences, not just with my portfolio, but also of my clients, they tend to only react when it's you know, getting. They don't react to the 60 and 90 day ones, put it that way. If it's a perfect world, they may react to the 30 day one, but to be honest, it's the 7 day one that they tend to react to. In terms of renewal notices, so I think if we also make realistic windows, that's going to help as well.
Okay, well, right now there's two proposals on the table. There's mine, which is essentially 6 weeks plus or minus 2 weeks, and 1 week plus or minus 3 days, or roughly. And James suggested 4 weeks plus or minus a few days or a week, and 1 week plus or minus 2 days. I see them roughly equivalent. I have no problem. I have no problem using either of them. No. There's several people who have said James is better, so we'll take him.
I'm coming down on the James is better side. Maybe
okay.
Of billing cycles, you tend to think in 30, 21 days.
Okay.
Outside of 30, you tend to ignore it.
Okay, so the 1 month plus or minus a few days or plus or minus a week?
I'm ambivalent on that.
Michele?
The billing cycle thing is very pertinent. Because, I mean, we would deal with a lot of companies who are used to the concept of 30-day increments.
Okay.
So moving out beyond the 30 days, I mean, James would say it. I don't know what Paul or the others would have in their own experience, but from our experience, it's 60-day notifications about things, people are kind of left scratching their heads going, why the hell are you telling me about this? Whereas, as Cheryl says, they're going to act probably a week or so before the expiry if they're going to act at all.
Okay. You don't have to sell me. As far as I'm concerned, it's changed unless anyone insists that we keep the options that I provided. Okay. 1 month plus or minus a week. One week plus or minus 3 days, I guess, to cover weekends. All right. No hands up. We'll go on to question number five. This is the question of how notices should be sent. This is the one where we had a huge laundry list of potential suggestions, and I ended up keeping the laundry list without trying to evaluate which made sense, which don't, and put them in as three options. Either they are recommended, the RA requires them, B, they are recommended as best practices, or C, and I added a new one. I seem to have B and C the same at this point. I'm going to have to go back to the original documents and see what the C was. Michele, is your hand new or the old one?
New. It's new.
Okay.
Just looking at your list of options there, referring to a specific service such as Twitter, I would be strongly against, on the basis that we have no way of knowing if Twitter will exist in 3 weeks' time, let alone in 2 years' time. The same with SMS. Again, while it's less likely that SMS as a technology is going to disappear, I would be wary of tying down to a specific technology. I'd prefer to use
text message.
Something like text message, possibly. And the Twitter one, I know what you're trying for, but if you're going to be looking at doing something which involves a change to a policy or to an RAA, we'd need to look at something a little more vague, I suppose.
To be quite candid, I cannot imagine this getting to the stage where the RAA says you must use Twitter, but I'm happy to take it out anyway. And
yeah, it's just the thing is...
Twitter's just a form of text messaging.
Yeah, well, there's just no point.
That's going to upset a bunch of people.
Yeah, exactly. That's going to happen anyway. So,
James?
Yeah, just to reiterate what Michele said just a little bit here, I think some of these are predicated on the idea that the SMS path has been provided or that the that the registrar or RAE is a fan of or is following the registrar on various social networks. And I would love for that to be the case for all of our customers, but I can't guarantee that. So I just agree with Michele that putting it into a policy is probably requires too much action on the part of the RAE.
As I said, I can't imagine this particular laundry list getting there. Okay, I owe you a statement of what option C really was. It may simply be status quo. I have to go back to my original documents. I would suggest that I send out by email what the option C is, and I send out this revised list, the revised meaning SMS is replaced by text message and Twitter disappears. And let's do some comments on email to refine this list. I don't want to spend too much time in the full meeting here talking about this level of detail. But I think we want a reasonable list for this questionnaire. Remember, this is not the policy. This is a poll and the draft report. Ron?
Yeah, just reminding you, though, that if it's not specifically stated in the RAA, then you don't have to change it in order to produce a best practices. And you've talked, or the group has talked, between specific changes and a document that says best practices, and that gets murky when we try to say one way to do it.
Well, indeed, and as I said, I left this option in as part of the policy because that's the general form of our questions. I can't imagine this one coming out like that in the ones that were very specific. There are other ones here about, you know, for instance, the registrar should insist that at least one email contact does not use the domain that is being registered, and I see that as perhaps a reasonable RA amendment. Again, I'm not trying to decide whether it's there or not, but I think that's a reasonable one. The other thing which I mentioned later on, and we may want something about it in the preamble, when we talk about best practices, there's an informal level of best practice that is documented somewhere that registrars can look at. The other thing, and I'd like, I later on ask for Cheryl's input, but I'll just mention now because it may apply here, of some sort of, Cheryl, what's the right terminology for a code of standards that registrars as a group can set up and then and any of them can endorse it and say they follow it and get the, you know, the little logo or icon on their site?
Cheryl's gone, Alan.
Ah. Cheryl is gone.
Cheryl's disconnected.
Okay. Well, we'll talk to her later. Okay, so I'll follow up this one on email, and we'll continue that at that point. Question number six. Should measures be implemented to ensure that registrants are aware that if their contact information is not up to date, they will not receive notices? Now, in our original prior discussions, this was the question that elicited all of those range of how to notify them, but didn't really address the actual question of how do we make sure that registrants understand. And so I reworked this in a way I think makes some sense, but it hasn't really been formally discussed. And the options that I've given, again, as a as either policy or recommended, is for web-based applications, the registrar needs a positive acknowledgement, you know, tick here or you can't proceed with the registration, that inaccurate or insufficient information could lead to loss of the domain. And for web-based applications, the registrar will point to an ICANN tutorial on the issue, and that's something we talked about before, of ICANN doing something like that, and of course then we need an option to point to it. Michele.
Is this in reference to at the time of registration or somewhere else?
At the time of registration or renewal, yes.
Well, obviously they're two different things. Is at the time of
аппарат абонента выключен или находится вне зоны действия сети. The subscriber's phone is switched off or out of the coverage.
Hello?
Hello.
Аппарат абонента выключен или находится...
Thank you, whoever did that. And Tatiana disconnected at the same time, so that may have been her line. Okay, go ahead, Michele, before it happens again.
Okay, no, just because at the time of reminder, it may not be web-based. Because let's say, for example, if a registrant is paying by credit card, and they have a credit card on the billing system of the registrar, if they don't explicitly remove the auto-renew or whatever functionality is provided by the registrar, then the domain will automatically renew. There's nothing interactive about it.
And
do you understand
that? I understand that, and that's why I worded these to imply, but perhaps poorly, that the rule only applies if there's a web interaction going on.
Oh, I see what you mean. Okay, that's fair enough. Sorry, Alan. I just wasn't. I wasn't very clear. It wasn't very clear to me.
Yeah, I mean, if I go into your system to renew, you gotta remind me again. Because at that point I may have completely obsolete information On the other hand, if it's done automatically, then life is hard and we don't get a chance to tell you.
That's fine. Yeah. No, it wasn't clear to me at what point of the process
You
were referring to. Sorry.
No other hands. We'll go on to the next one. We're now into the area of post-expiration. And I have a note saying that there's a preamble, which was, I think, question number five, which really said, should there be additional measures? But we never got into that particular question didn't address them, so I moved that into a preamble, not a question. And I note that's the only place in the survey we use the buzzword auto-renew grace period, and I didn't have time when I was doing this to try to clean that up, but I think we need to remove it from this questionnaire if it's to have meaning. I just noticed that Marika sent me a notice that on the one about various ways of sending email, option C should have been do nothing. Unfortunately, I don't. I'm working from a paper document here, so I haven't been following the chat. If there's something that's really important to say, someone has to tell me. And Cheryl also said she's gone. Okay. All right. The post-expiration, the first one is who is. Now, there were two different issues that we talked about on who is. One is the actual EPP status, which is reflected in the who is. And the other is a more general, some sort of dialogue or other information in the who is that will tell a registrant exactly what's going on. And I've tried to generalize the question to reflect both situations. That is not being specific in how to implement it, but the general message should be that when you look at who is, it's clear what's happening. And the two options are either we do it or we don't. I added the caveat that it's understood that this is likely will likely require EPP changes, and just to make sure that people say, "Oh, didn't you realize that's going to be really difficult?" And I think the answer is yes, we realize it might be difficult, but the E is in EPP is for extensible, so maybe we need to extense. If that's a word. Michele.
Yeah, I think, I mean, look, if changes are required, then so be it. I mean, there's no reason why, you know, the sacred cow of EPP shouldn't be modified if it makes life easier for registrars, registrants, and registries.
I think the timing of Verisign's.net domain exchange, our step request, was very timely. It demonstrated that registrars have no problem with EPP changes, registries, if they see some reason for it.
Well, if it's in many cases, the registries are pushing through changes for their requirements and their needs. So, for example, VeriSign changed the EPP key formats a few months ago, and it wasn't a question of whether the registrars had any choice in the matter. We were simply told, you know, this is changing. You need to update your system so that you generate an EPP key using this particular algorithm.
I think we have unanimity on this in this working group at this point. It may be the only thing we have unanimity on, that the threat of an EPP change is not enough reason not to do it.
Exactly.
All right. Now, are post-expiration notices required? And I tried to raise the issue that there is a question of whether there is a contract go on or not, and some registrars have raised that issue. And I also tried to cover the issue that Michele mentioned of there are situations where there is no opportunity to renew, and post-expiration notices make no sense at that point. And I gave as options one message or two messages. Again, I can't see mandating more than that, although I could see any given registrar deciding to do more. And with the three variants, policy, best practice or status quo do nothing. Any comments? None. All right. Now we go into the discussion of what happens to the various uses of the domain name when DNS queries are done. And I've broken it down into the two most common ones that come up in discussion. One is the web, and the second is email, and then a catch-all for everything else. And here you'll notice I have a question of when registrars right now have a splash page, perhaps monetized, perhaps not, or for that matter for a parked domain, do registrars tend to cover HTTPS, port 443, or do they only do port 80, unencrypted? Anyone on the call know? Because it would be useful to know whether it's a varying practice, it's universal to ignore the secure port, or everyone always does it. Michele?
I can only speak from what I've seen myself. I mean, we probably wouldn't do anything with port 443, because if we start doing something with port 443, then what are we going to do with the other, I don't know how many ports that could potentially exist?
443 is the only common one that's used, you know, that one often gets requests for. That is, you will very often find a link in another page pointing with pointing to a domain with an HTTPS.
No, I understand what you're saying, Alan, but the point, what I'm trying to say to you is that once you move away from port 80, fine, but you know, you could be using any number of other ports. And you've also got the thing there about blah.domain.tld. That would be, it depends on how the registrars has handled it technically. Because to be able to catch every single subdomain or potential subdomain, you'd have to create a wildcard record in DNS to do it.
Yeah. No, the gist of those two highlighted ones were not for try to sell what we should do, but just for information to start the process of what do registrars tend to do right now. And in both cases, I know technically they're possible. The question is, do people do it or not? And I really don't know the answer to that. Do we have James? Yeah.
Yeah, just pointing out that I've run some tests while you and Michele were speaking, and not only does it not, it seems to time out on HTTPS, as well as, I think, I'm not an expert on SSL, but I think that might possibly open up some interesting inconsistencies in how the browser would handle that, and whether it would just, you know, say it was an untrusted site or something like that. I'm not really sure how that would work, but
no,
I think keeping it at port 80 is probably the most simplest and most sane approach.
Yeah, the reason I was asking is if there was a fair body of people who did 443, then I would want to allow that. You know, that is not disallow it.
Well, so we should set port 80 as the recommendation, and that any other ports, of course, are at the registrar's discretion.
Well, but the other ports we're going to cover in recommending that they stop working, because they're not web-based ports by default. Okay, I think it's something we need to go a little bit wider into our more common registrars and get a definitive answer saying we don't do it or we do it, just to have some idea that we can set reasonable policy again, assuming we end up with policy, that we set a reasonable one. And the same is true for the subdomain one. It's certainly possible. The question is that what people normally do or not? And I don't think we need to discuss it right now, but I will follow up an email and try to get some answers from a number of registrars. Michele, is that a new hand?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I've just tested a domain that I know is expired with another registrar, one of the larger ones.
Uh-huh.
And so the wildcarding seems to have implemented the wildcarding, but I'm still waiting for my browser to do something with HTTPS.
Okay, so it's likely there's no nothing listening and it's going to time out.
It'll probably time out. I mean, based on the kind of, like with from our own system, I would suspect that if you were to attempt a HTTPS on any domain that isn't resolving to a web address, HTTPS on our end would probably time out, and I suspect a lot of others would have the same thing. And as James said, you're going to have all sorts of interesting messages appearing in browsers about untrusted God knows what and blah, blah, blah. So.
I don't think so, because anyone can host a secure page.
No, it'll give you back an error about the SSL cert, because...
You're right. Sorry, I'm...
Self-signed.
I'm blathering, you're right. There is an issue there, and that's the reason why people don't do it.
Right.
Because the certificate will not be found for that site.
Exactly.
Okay. That's a security issue. And the second one, I suspect the practice varies, but I suspect commonly there is a wild card. I mean, again, if it's only from the interest of monetization, you want to catch as many pages as possible. So I suspect from that perspective, it probably is generally done. We need to follow up a little bit on it. But, okay, let's get on to the recommendation in general, is that the options are a policy that says the domain must stop working after some reasonable number of days. And the reasonable number of days, I think we need to specify to give registrars a little bit of latitude in that, you know, don't penalize them for not doing it within, you know, 3 microseconds. On the other hand, it should be a short enough number of time in my mind that it's a useful method of notifying the registrant. Ron, you had your hand up and then put it back?
Oh, well, it was just on the previous thing of 443. I mean, virtual hosting, let's say with Apache, works for port 80 or for any other port, but the mechanism of SSL requires a specific IP address. So you can't share a given single IP address with named virtual hosting for SSL verification. So that makes a very complicated thing for a registrar to try to handle 443, I think.
Yeah, again, I wasn't trying to advocate it. I just wanted to know if they do it by default, and where we seem to be in the conversation is there are technical reasons why they don't do why they don't and probably can't do it. So I, you know, that's gone now. It was something that crossed my mind as I was drafting this. Any discussion on the on the recommendation, and can we define several days to, let's say, 3? Is that reasonable, or 2? James, your GoDaddy, I think, is one of the registrars that explicitly keeps a domain live for a few days. And presumably that's a courtesy to registrants if there is a credit card authorization problem or something like that. And that is, don't take the name down if you're actually in the midst, perhaps, of fixing the expiration. Sorry? James is on
James
mute.
He's gone.
You're right, he's gone. Any other comments on it? I'll ask him explicitly on that one. But I think if we say plus or minus or within 2 days, is that reasonable? I don't like the term several. It's too undefined. Ron?
Yes, this is Ron again.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think when you made the reference to if you're in communication with the expired domain name holder, then that should be allowed to have any options it's the issue comes up if you're unable to contact what should be the requirement for doing it. But if you're in contact with the person, then that you can work it out between yourselves. I don't think the policy has to say what has to do when you're in contact.
I'm not quite sure how one would word in contact, which implies to me that there's bidirectional discussion going on as opposed to unidirectional. But
that's correct.
I understand the intent of what you're saying, and I suspect we should try to get some words from registrars who can perhaps give us some words that we can use in that. But I agree with the concept. Anything else on 9? All right. Email is the next issue. And this one is a difficult one in that partly the problem we brought on to ourselves is that we gave a number of options in the first survey which are likely impractical and many are impossible in the more general sense. So here I try to refine it to something which I think is implementable and will achieve the desired end. And the recommendation essentially is to, within some number of days, the similar situation to the previous one, make it stop working. And the other options, of course, are best practice or status quo. Any comments? I know Shiva had some concerns with that. Is there anyone else who feels uncomfortable at this point with this direction? Is there anyone still on the call except McKaylee and me and Ron? No other comments? Then it's done.
Can I voice my support of it?
Yes, please. Otherwise, I'm just a voice to the wilderness here.
No. I mean, from my perspective, the options A and option B both make perfect sense to me.
Okay.
Anything beyond that doesn't make much sense to me.
Yeah, I'm sympathetic with the argument that email is important to people and you don't want to interrupt it unless you absolutely have to. But if the alternative is 3 weeks later, it not only disappears, but it disappears permanently with no additional notice, and someone else may be in a position to intercept your email, I think going dead for a while is a better option.
Alan, I get email. I've actually had to disable email on several domains simply because the previous owners of the domains never paid their bills to their suppliers. The thing is, if you want to, if email is so important to you, then you need to make sure that the domain is renewed.
Yeah.
So if your email is that important to you, then surely reading the bills from your suppliers is also important, and surely you're capable of acting on those in a timely fashion. So.
In a moment, Shiva. McKaylee, I think that's a little bit going too far because, if nothing else, we already in an earlier one said you should really use another domain for expiration notices other than the domain in question. And that, of course, could be an email address at your ISP where you lived last and you've since moved. So people don't get messages for valid reasons, not only because they're blithely ignoring them. This is
part of the thing I have with the idea that people should use another email address for the domain, because what commonly happens is that somebody might be using a free Gmail or a Hotmail or their ISP email address, but once they start using an actual domain name,
they'll stop checking that email. So in some respects, it's actually, it's a circular problem. It's
well, pre-expiration, it's better to use one that we know is working. Post-expiration, it's exactly the opposite. So.
Yeah, it's a bit of an awkward one.
I think we should, every time you register a domain name, we should get a tether onto your nose and they can just yank it.
Tempting.
Maybe hard over the internet. Siva, you had a comment.
Yeah, Michelle was saying that if a person is not interested in renewing his domain, email is not important for him. I would rather not assume that way. A person fails to renew his domain for various reasons, and email to him is in any way very, very important. So we should give due consideration to email functionality.
Steve, I'll have to disagree with you. I mean, if the email is important to them, then they need to make sure that they're paying for the service that provides them with the emails. And that's like, I mean, I like having a roof over my head, but I know damn well if I don't pay my landlord my rent, I'll end up out in the street. It's, you know, it's the same with my office. If I don't pay the rent for my office, I can hardly expect to have use of it. If I don't pay my electricity bill, they will cut me off. It's the same with my gas bill. I mean, I need gas for cooking. I mean, you know, I can't, if I don't pay for these services, how can I expect somebody to provide them to me for free?
Stephen, let me ask you a very explicit question. You're suggesting that after expiration, the registrar attempt to leave email working. Is that correct?
I don't imply indefinitely.
No. I'm not talking indefinitely. I'm talking within the first 30 or 45 days.
For the first 30 or 45 days, I think the email should continue working.
Okay,
and,
fine.
If the registrar does not have space in its servers, then an alternate technical solution can be found.
No, I just wanted to make sure I understood your position. Now I have a question. If you are the registrant for this particular domain, which is you being used for email, the domain has expired, you have not renewed it, you have ignored or did not receive all the previous messages.
Yeah, but it can happen in so many situations. One, I'm not officially in charge of renewing my domain name. Someone else in my company is in charge.
No.
Even if I'm supposed to renew domain names myself, I sometimes forget.
You have... Siva, please let me finish the question.
Okay.
The question is, if you are using this domain for email, you have not renewed it, it has expired, but you don't want us to cut it off, what will happen in the next 30 or 45 days or 50 days, whatever, which will make you suddenly realize that you have to pay the fee? Because within a small number of days, 30, 40, 50, 100, whichever we decide on, that domain will go away permanently.
Yeah, I know that.
And if there is
a cushion, I'll at least notice during
how,
the next 30 days or 45 days.
How will you notice if it keeps on working?
No, because you keep sending notices. We are talking about reminders being sent to the registrant, and one reminder or another will invariably catch my attention, and I'll wake up.
Not if the reminders are going to somebody who left your company, as you just said. If they're going to the accountant and the accountant left, that mail is going nowhere.
No, I didn't say that the person would have left. I'm saying that someone else is in charge and he's not so careful.
Okay,
that's what I implied.
Siva, we're going to run out of time. I'd like to continue this discussion on email.
Okay,
and Michele, if this is a new subject, fine. If it's a new rebuttal, let's defer to email.
Well, all I wanted to say is just one small thing. It's you know, if we disable the web, that's fine for a domain where they're using the web. But if the domain is only being used for email, you get back to the same thing. So I don't know. If you can just continue this on the email list, but I don't think there's going to be agreement on this point.
Okay, let's go on. And the next question is for other services. That is, we're not specifying, it's not port 80, and it's not deemed to be email. Whether it is an SQL server or whether it's an FTP server or whether it's a gaming site using a random port or a moving port doesn't matter. The question being posed here is if the registrar has the option of allowing it to stay working or breaking it, what should they do? And A says break it. B says best practice, break it. C says whatever happens, happens, and it's not a matter of policy. Again, I'm of the opinion that you need to break everything because that's what may cause someone to realize there is a problem. Any support against it? Any support for it?
Can I just say I support it?
I love it when you say that, Michaela.
I mean, in many respects, if you give me an option between A, B, and C, I'll probably opt for any one of the three. I don't have any strong feelings towards it because in many respects, I'd see other services as being moot and moot for a lot of these things. But that's just my own personal thing. No, I mean, I don't have any. I support it anyway.
Okay. I mean, I was gonna make an irreverent comment, but I won't. All right,
I'll go on. You know you won't. So.
No, I'm gonna.
I can't beat you up at this distance, Alan.
We won't try. Okay, question 15 is what happens with a transfer during the expiration period. Now, if you remember correctly, Marika, can we get up on the comment there? Okay. If you remember correctly, at the last meeting, the status was we had been pointed to a compliance notice from a year and a half ago that says registrars may not refuse a request to transfer during expiration except in a number of extreme cases. And the question came up is, what if the registrant does not have the ability to request the transfer, either because they have been cut off on the registrar's web-based system, or they cannot request, they cannot change the status to a way that the receiving registrar can enact the transfer? There's a whole host of reasons that they cannot make the request. And the answer that came back from compliance, I'm going to try to summarize it, but Marika, tell me if I'm going past the bounds of reasonableness. Essentially, it says it's not our problem. That what happens past expiration is governed by the registration agreement, and it is not our problem. To ensure that the registrant has a way of talking to the registrar and making the request. And I agree that there is the situation under current policy. I'm not happy that that's the interpretation of it, but it probably is the letter of the law. Marika, was that a fair summary? I'm clearly negative on this, but I'm trying to not put words in someone's mouth.
Yeah, this is Marika, and I think you're correct that you know there's no policy or you know contractual obligations at that point that are in place. Apart from, of course, the scenario that's prescribed in the advisory where transfer has already been initiated. There are certain rules that
basically
dictate when that you cannot deny a transfer in certain circumstances, amongst which if you haven't paid yet for the future registration period. But on the point, you're correct.
Yeah. No, they can deny it if you haven't made for the previous one, but you don't have to pay for the current for the one starting now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ron.
Is the attribution of the final sentence my own experiences? Is that the person who responded to the person from compliance responding that it's their own experience? Or?
This is Marika. Maybe to add that, because I specifically asked as well, whether they were aware of any instances or many complaints related to this kind of scenario. And actually, I didn't put the first part of the feedback there, and they actually reviewed the complaints, I think, received between June and December of last year, and they couldn't actually find any complaint that related to this specific scenario in which a registrant tries to transfer domain name following expiration and cannot do so because, you know, either he or she is no longer listed as the registrant and who is details, or the losing registrar refuses to cooperate as they don't consider the registrant anymore the legitimate registrant because the contract or the agreement has expired. So I think that's why that sentence was added, basically saying that, you know, there are no complaints because they suggested that they already initiated before that time.
I guess my inclination at this point is to put put the question in the survey, stating what the current situation is and asking, do we want to enact policy requiring a registrar to allow a request for transfer during the AGR, the ARGP period? Michele?
Just based on our own experiences, what we would do if people are trying to transfer domains to us as the gaming registrar, we would first off encourage them to initiate that well in advance of the renewal date as possible. And secondly, if the domain is about to expire, even if there's only a few, less than a week to expiry, we would generally try and suggest that they renew the domain with the current registrar. Because apart from anything else, there can be issues with EPP keys or people having odd contact details that aren't 100% up to date, etc., etc., etc. Obviously if they've initiated the transfer before the domain's expiry, then it's no longer an issue. But once it's gone past a certain point, it'll automatically be into that 5-day.
I'm assuming, and I have no personal experience on this, that we're talking about a situation where the registrant intends to renew, otherwise there's no point in transferring to a new registrar, but they do not want to renew with that particular the registrar of record right now, and I'm presuming that only happens if there has been a major philosophical split or the terms and conditions that the registrar is requesting for this renewal are deemed to be outrageous by the registrant. I'm assuming those are the only two rationales for why you would want to do it now and not a week from now.
Well, the only thing I would say is, if you're going to, there's nothing to stop somebody from renewing the domain with Registrar A, say, the day of its expiry, and then transferring it to Registrar B.
Аппарат абонента выключен или находится вне зоны действия сети.
Michele, unless, of course, the current registrar of record is asking an outrageous price for renewal. And I'm not saying that happens. I'm just saying that's about
the only
rationale. You know, you want to renew $400, please. We've got you by the, symbolic body parts.
But if the registrar is charging those kind of rates on renewal compared to registration, I suspect that they're going to be having other issues with compliance.
They may well, but that doesn't address the registrant's issue of the day.
not directly. But if the registrar in question were doing, let's say odd things, then I suspect that there'd be a lot more going on there.
Yeah,
than just
I suspect the situation happens in the scenario which
is certainly not the norm, but we there is abundant anecdotal evidence that it happens. That is, a domain expires because of the semantics of the name or because of the initial results from monetization, the registrar or reseller realizes it as high value and charges the registrant a much larger amount to renew. How often that happens, we don't know, but we know it happens on occasion. And that's a rationale for transferring.
Alan, the situation of a registrar not being open to communication for a certain period, this can be tackled by making registrars open for communication to another registrar on behalf of the registrant. So this can be handled in a much better way at the registrar level, at the inter-registrar level, between non-registrar level.
I'm not sure how one would do that contractually.
The registrant authorizes a new registrar to take over his domain, and then that new registrar approaches the previous registrar and takes over, as simple as that.
I think the actual mechanics are perhaps a little bit more difficult. Is there any objection to me trying to word something here and, again, putting it on email and, see, you know, trying to judge between now and the next week whether it goes ahead or not?
Put something in. Alan. I mean,
okay.
We can just disagree with it if we don't like it.
Yeah. Okay. Next section is contractual conditions. This is the ones that had to do with the actual registration agreements. The first one is the one on where to find the renewal information, and I've tried to word something that talks about the options of ICANN putting in place rules, best practices, or status quo. And this is one where I was asking Cheryl, and I'll do it offline with her, to try to put in some words. Now, in the issue, I was trying to replicate the kind of discussion that we've had here a number of times of registrars using arguments that you cannot use very simple, clean language because there are legal constraints and legal advice on the registrar side saying we have to cover ourselves. Now, I don't want to use words like that in this document. Is there anyone in the registrar community, and I'm not sure who's left here other than Kaylee, just you? Okay, I'll ask this one explicitly in email because I don't want to put you on the spot here. But if we
I probably wouldn't be able to answer you anyway. So.
Yeah. You are one of the ones that has made the argument, but I don't think I'm going to ask you to speak on behalf of all registrars.
No, please don't.
You know, I think it's an issue that has been brought up time and time again, and I don't think we can pretend it's not being raised, but I'm trying to find some diplomatic words in which to phrase it.
I think there are two things, Alan. One is in relation to the registration agreement. Once you put the words, when you specify a registration agreement, then you're into the legal quagmire. Whereas information on a registrar's website, like we have a wiki, we have an FAQ, we have a bunch of other things, and, you know, whoever wants to put information on there from our staff can do so. I'm sure some of the registrars probably have people who are specialized in
registration. They do indeed, and the good guys, as it were, do that. The question is, we're looking at policy for the guys who aren't good.
Exactly.
And I mean, you just made the statement again, saying, you know, in the legal document we have to do such and such, and you know, there are examples in the world where legal documents are written differently. But I'm just trying to get that statement made in a way that does not sound pejorative, but reflects the situation.
The bit you have when you're in the issue section there, you're saying just clearly display it on a registrar website. See, that I don't have any issue with. Because you're not mandating where.
Yeah, but I'm there. If you remember correctly, in the discussion leading up to this one,
the initial discussion was things like clearly displayed on the website, and because we could not define clear, the group almost unanimously said put it in the registration agreement. And then that brings back the whole issue of the registration agreements are obscure and difficult to understand. I have no problem at all if we were to change this completely and say it doesn't go in the agreement. I mean, you can put it in the agreement if you want, but the clearly on the website is really the issue. But there was a strong desire from this group, you know, with people who aren't here at the moment, that we do put it in the registration agreement. So
maybe something best to follow up on the list, Alan.
Yeah. Okay. The cost of where to find the cost of recovery? There, we you know, it's a similar sort of question. Recovery grace period, redemption grace period, is the last one, and this is a difficult one. The redemption grace period came in 2002 or 2003. If you talk to people at the time, everyone thought it was going to become a consensus policy, but no one actually did the footwork to do that, and therefore it isn't a consensus policy. The only registries that have adopted it are the most of the non-sponsored ones, with the exception of Name and Pro, and none of the sponsored ones. And the question is, where does that leave us with respect to the new GTLDs which are going to be coming on board? It's hard to imagine that any of them, or certainly many of them, will adopt the RGP as a voluntary service if it's not required. I think we'll see the exact same situation. I think Paul's words are, there's no reason to believe history won't repeat itself. And we then have an awkward problem, do we? So the numbers from .com and .org and .net say the usage is not heavy, but it's non-trivial. And my inclination is to say that we go ahead and try to make it a policy at this point, since there's not likely to be any other process. Any thoughts, Michele, since you and I seem to be having the discussion? Well, Ron is still here, though. Go ahead, Ron.
Ron's agreeing.
Ron is agreeing. He's agreeing that we should try to make it a policy. The question is giving the background there and simply saying do it or don't do it. I personally would like to see it happen, but
the only problem I would have is if there's an exception.
Is
if you introduce an exception, so you've got here possibly with an exception allowed for some GTLDs. I don't see how that will help.
I guess what I was getting at, and I was trying to cover the objections which we haven't had the discussion yet, is are there currently or will there be GTLDs where the concept just doesn't make sense because of how the GTLD will be managed or used? You know, think of it as in .museum or something like that. Where there's an accreditation process, it's not people applying out of the blue. And I just don't know enough about the business models to say, is that putting an onerous stress on them to have them implement something which just doesn't make any sense in their business model? I don't know the answer, which is why I said I think we need to have a discussion with the registry, since we don't have any on this call.
Ron has something to say.
Yeah, go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, well, just from the point of view that it's a small number. Nothing in what we would propose would suggest that they have to do it programmatically. They just have to offer it, even with a telephone call. So if it has, so if it's a small. If it's a small .museum one, then it may only come up once every 5 years. So handling that manually shouldn't be burdensome.
Is that a reasonable statement from a registrar's point of view, Michele?
I'm not a registry operator. You know,
I said, is it from registrar's point of view, where you would perhaps be expected to handle an RGP request, but would have to do it manually?
Well, if I could charge enough to cover the costs of doing that and it wouldn't break my back end badly, then okay. The problem I have with non-automated processes is that while you're trying your best to do something to help somebody, if it breaks the kind of integration on the back end, it comes back and bites you like 12 months or 18 months later or whatever.
Yeah, I'm not even sure. My recollection of discussions with Chuck was that this was a partially manual operation on the registry's part for several years. And I think it's only recently, if at all, that it's fully automated from the registry-registrar interaction. I'm not even sure it is.
Yeah,
we're talking on registries, you know, for .com and .net, an average of maybe 10 a day. It's not the largest of businesses.
No, I mean, considering the number of deletes that they'd have in .com and .net per day,
yeah.
10 doesn't even map to a clean percentage. I mean, it'd be kind of not.
Okay, I think your comment is well-founded, and that may reduce the need for an exception, and I'll mention that when I try to make some contact with them.
Okay.
So that's a good thought, and I guess I was in the mode of everything being automated, but that in fact makes sense. Yes, there is some merit to multiple minds being better than one. And the next one, which this is almost a progression, but they're not quite required, the previous one required. The next one is, should registrars be required to implement it for registries that offer it, which may or may not be all of them. The real catch here is for a registrar that might delete names early or doesn't give any other opportunity for recovery, the RGP is the only game in town. And if a registrar doesn't implement access to the RGP, and as Michele pointed out, at whatever price is needed, because registrars set their own price for the RGP, then the registrant is left without any option whatsoever. So my inclination is to push for this one. It doesn't affect very many registrars because most of them already offer it. No hands, no comments. I'm assuming rabid support in the absence of any negative comments. And the last one is transfer during RGP. This becomes somewhat moot if the previous one is enacted as a policy. It only becomes more interesting if you have left in a position where the RGP is your only mechanism of recovery and the registrar of record does not offer it, which essentially says the last of the safety nets goes away. So whether I think this one is important depends on how the previous one comes out. Michele?
Just one problem here is if the domain is going to RGP, then the whois details probably would have changed dramatically. So how would you actually enact it at a technical level? I can't see how you do it.
Just a thought. Even if a registrar chooses not to offer RGP, the only thing I would say, one option is that they have to refer it. An inquiry from a registrant would have to be referred to the registry, and then the registry should be in a position to address it directly from an unwilling registrar.
I would think that's a reasonable alternative, albeit somewhat more complex, because you know that registry is now going to have to unilaterally transfer to another registrar to actually do the registration, since registries can't do them themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not quite as complex as the mechanism might be in what's proposed. I think what you're proposing may be more difficult. Michele, I'm not sure I understand your question.
With a thick registry, the registry would hold a set of the WHOIS data prior to expiration, and then obviously if there were any updates made to the WHOIS data, they would also have access to that. In a thin registry, they don't have access to it at all.
But that doesn't change whether the registrar has a business practice of honoring the RGP or not. I mean,
if I've removed all WHOIS data from a domain, there's no way to transfer it.
Is that allowed?
Well, no. If it's gone into RGP, I'm not even too sure what would appear in WHOIS.
But if it's in RGP, it's in a hold status. I don't remember the exact EPP word, but it's in a hold status. And presumably you're not allowed to flush your WHOIS cache at that point. The domain still exists.
Yep, I'm just wondering what appears and who is at that status. I'm not actually 100% sure what would happen. If the registrar becomes the registrant after expiry, then, yeah.
I would think you would need a rule to make this happen. You would need a rule saying if who is was changed to change the owner during the expiration process, which some registrars do, prior to the time of delete, it would have to be changed back, which is exactly what happens if the registrar does honor the RGP. Because remember, it's the registrar who recognizes the registrant.
Yes.
I mean, that's the whole rationale for not doing what Ron suggested, is because the registry does not know, even if it says Michele Nalon, how do I know who you are?
Well, the registry wouldn't be able to do it on a thin one anyway. They would never have had the WHOIS details.
Yeah, but presumably, assuming they now have the right to go into the registrar's data and do a WHOIS and look at the thin details. But we're talking about mechanisms. All we're saying here is if you can't flush your WHOIS cache because the domain still exists, and that surely is violating some rule.
Probably.
And presumably, if you do a delete, if you do a delete and you're honoring the RGP, presumably you either change the WHOIS back to the original registrant if you had changed it, or at least you know in your back of the envelope who it was. Mm. And that doesn't have to be any different. That's no different if you don't honor the RGP but now have to honor a transfer. Again, I'm not trying to design the transaction, but I don't think the mechanism is it's either you're telling the registry to do the restore, or you're telling or the receiving registrar has to be able to say I want to do the recovery and a restore, the transfer and a restore. My inclination is to say it's a lot cleaner if everyone has to honor the RGP, even at an outrageous price, and not have to worry about it. But okay, we are over time. We're out of questions. Any comments before we break? Otherwise, I think I'm not quite sure what we want to do for next week, but since we've had such a poor turnout as we went on this week, I think we'll clean this up and put it back on the agenda, and it may be a short meeting. And I think we do have to talk a bit more about what else has to be done in the report and how do we get it done in the next three weeks or so. So, Marika, I guess you and I have to do a little bit of brainstorming between now and then.
Okay.
For those
those who have hung on this far, I thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is one of the few meetings we now have more staff on this meeting than we have had participants. So to all of those silent staff people, thank you. Assuming you're really here. And we'll see each other whenever we see on our next meeting.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.